Though, yes, he's also the governor of Denham's son. Right, right. That's what I meant. Gideon dragged his gaze back to me. Are you happy? Of course. He's a cultured, industrious man who's going to be in charge of an entire colony. He's financially secure and will have the respect of everyone in Haddison, and outside of it. And what about his wife? His wife will have the best of everything. Do you love him? Does he love you? We respect each other, and from what I've seen, that'll get me further than love. Gideon winced, catching the barb. And what about her? I might have called him out for avoiding saying Mary's name, but given the open setting, vagueness was probably better. I'll deal with that after we're married, and bring it up in a way that he'll be accommodating to. You've helped me realize waiting is the best strategy, and I'm grateful to have learned that before I ruined a legitimately good prospect. There was no sunshine in Gideon's face today. I deserve that, he said unexpectedly. And, Tamsin, I've been thinking a lot about what I said. No. The prim, cool demeanor I'd been holding up was tossed away. Don't go down that road, Gideon. Don't start confessing your regrets. He glanced around anxiously. But I have them, Tamsin. I've done a lot of thinking and praying, and you were right. You're always right. I was being a hypocrite. I advocate for people embodying their ideals, yet I was embodying what I despise. The empty customs and rules that I complain about, well, I was applying them to you to cover my own insecurity. Your apology is accepted. Tamsin, I want to do more than apologize. I was wrong. I was shocked and said things I shouldn't have. I still want to marry you. It's not too late. His grey eyes were wide and frantic. There's a colony being chartered. It's called Westhaven. I've heard of it. Then you know they allow freedom of religion. Early settlers have to buy into it, but after we're married and rebuild my money, we can move there and work on my new enterprise. You can be part of that, an invaluable assistant to a wondrous creation. The passion and anguish on his face did move me. No matter what had happened, I didn't want him to suffer. But the thought of me going back to him was ludicrous. Gideon, I already get to assist in a wondrous creation, the forming of a colony. If you want my advice, don't wait to join Westhaven. Spend your savings on buying into it now, not paying off a bridal contract. Go. Be happy. That's what I plan to do. He wilted. Isn't there any way I can change your mind? I'll do practically anything. I wondered if he realized the impact of his word choice. Practically anything. Jago had been willing to do everything. I'm fixed on my path, I said. And now you need to find yours. Tamsin, Gideon reached toward me, and I stepped back. I really do love you. I examined his face, the raw emotion burning in his eyes. But not enough, I said. Goodbye, Gideon. Warren was full of apologies when he finally showed up that evening, explaining how business and bureaucracy had tied him up longer than expected. Two of his associates were with him and quickly loaded my trunk into a waiting carriage. We'll have to make part of our trip in the dark, Warren added, but we'll still arrive tonight. I hope it's not too exhausting. Jasper answered for me. No need to worry. Our Tamsin can handle anything. Mira stood near him, trying to hide her sadness, but her dark eyes gave her away. I wished I could have offered a longer goodbye, but there was little to be said that we hadn't already shared earlier. I gave her a hug, told her I'd see her soon, and then followed Warren and his men. I'd grown well acquainted with Cape Triumph in my time here, and had often seen the busy part of the port, the section of the bay where ships going to and from Usfred, or coastal colonies, docked. Farther west along the bay, a smaller cluster of buildings along the water managed ships sailing inland, not to the ocean. Here, we boarded the boat bound for Haddison. When I'd heard how only small vessels could dock on the far side of the bay, I'd worried we'd be travelling in a dinghy. But Warren's boat was about 40 feet long and even had a small enclosed bit of cabin on its deck. The cabin had a partition dividing it into two sections. A few chairs sat inside one half, and Warren urged me to make myself comfortable. Gazing at the red and purple sky of sunset, I told him I'd stay out on the deck for a little while. It was wide and flat, with plenty of space to sit, and being near the water was already cooling me off. The boat had a crew of two, and the captain had a hushed conversation with Warren before we set off. He pointed at the sky, then gestured at the bay. After a little more back and forth, the captain shrugged and ordered his crewmate to start untying. Warren and his two men, Lawrence and Earl, sat near me and watched the shoreline depart. Shrugging out of his jacket, Warren said, "Forgive the informality, but this heat is cooking me alive. The captain says it's going to cool off soon, though. He expects it to rain, but that cabin is snug and dry. And once we arrive on the other side, we'll have a covered carriage, too." "I'm surprised you can get in a boat at all, Miss Wright," Lawrence told me, "after what you went through at sea." "Well, I still arrived safely, didn't I? And I did a lot of water travel in Grashand, so I've gotten used to it again." The shore had become nothing but a black edge around the water now, dotted with the lights of buildings and street lamps. It helps being able to see land. At sea, there's nothing but water and more water. Earl shuddered.
"I've never left Adoria. Can't say I want to."
"Of course you do."
Warren gave him an easy smile.
"You've got to see the old country, and Avaria too. I spent almost 2 years over there, touring the continent. You see the old cathedrals of Lorendi and statues of Ruva, and it'll make Adoria seem like an upstart."
"All the more reason not to go," said Earl.
"I'll keep my happy delusions." We laughed at that and discussed various light subjects as the voyage continued. Warren had a picnic dinner of sorts for us, and there was an almost party-like atmosphere to it all. I felt like I had wings, like I could have launched off and flown to Adoria. Everything I wanted was within my grasp. The weather soon cooled, and the promised rain began, just a sprinkle at first. I traded my plumed hat for a hooded velvet cloak. It was around that same time that the boat began angling toward the shore, and I looked over at Warren in concern. "Is something wrong?" I asked. We were heading south when Haddison was due west across the bay.
"No, no. I should have mentioned it earlier. We're picking up two additional passengers, associates of mine. I'm sorry for the added delay when we're already late. You must be exhausted."
"I'm just fine. You take care of what you need to." The wind had picked up by then, and a low rumble of thunder made me clench at the railing. Warren patted my shoulder. "We're not in the middle of the ocean, and this is no tempest. Everything's going to be okay, Tamsin. May I call you that?"
"Of course," I answered, smiling.
He strolled over to the captain and had a murmured conversation. Because of the late hour, they had to navigate in the darkness and were questioning the small port where Warren's associates waited. They found it, though, bringing us up to a long wharf in front of a small fishing village. Lights shone in the windows of scattered houses, and two men in cloaks waited at the wharf's end. One held a lantern and waved a hand in greeting as the other caught a line tossed by the captain's assistant. The two new passengers stepped aboard, hunched over and holding their cloaks. As the captain shoved off, Warren shouted brief introductions over the increasing rain.
"Tamsin, this is Mr. Smith and Mr. Carpenter. Gentlemen, Miss Wright."
We all stammered out appropriate greetings, though I barely heard theirs, and mine likely sounded mumbled too. A gust of wind threatened to rip off my hood, and I pulled it low, huddling in upon myself. Warren leaned his hand down to mine as he steered me toward the cabin.
"No need for you to get drenched. There's a tiny cabin with a bed you can rest on. We'll be in shortly, and hopefully won't bother you while we go over business in the dining area. Earl, take her in and see that she's settled."
I started to follow, pausing a moment to watch the captain and the other crew member as they fought with the lines of the sail in the lashing rain. Inside the main cabin, Earl told me, "I heard Mr. Doyle talking to them. The captain says it'll be bumpy, but that we'll be okay if we just keep riding the swell of the waves. This boat's low and solid enough that it's not likely to tip." "Not likely to?" I asked uneasily. Earl grinned. "It's fine. He says the biggest problem is just staying on course. Coming down here meant getting closer to some of the southern buoys than he'd like, so now he's got a job ahead of him to fight the wind and pull us back out." "What are the buoys for?" I asked, rubbing my hands together. This small cabin contained only a simple table with benches and a lantern, but it was warm and dry and wonderful. "They mark the shoals and shallow rocks on this half of the bay. They're dangerous for bigger ships, not us. But we need to be well north of them to stay on the course to Hedison. Here you are." Earl opened a small door that slipped from his hand when the ship suddenly pitched sharply to the starboard side. Thunder boomed outside, and the door swung out and clattered against the wall. He winced and grabbed the door again. "Sorry. Let's try again." I peered inside the second cabin. There wasn't much to it, just a pallet big enough for one person, which took up most of the room. I thanked Earl, and he told me to let them know if I needed anything. I pulled the door shut and couldn't quite make it catch. Leaning closer, I saw part of the latch had broken, probably when it slammed against the wall just now. I got the door to stay shut as best it could, though it left about an inch gap. No matter. Warren might think I'd be more comfortable here, but I wasn't sure I could actually stand being in a room without windows for very long. I stretched out on the thin mattress, which was more comfortable than it looked. The rest of the men stomped inside the other room, and the wind's volume rose momentarily until they closed the outer door. I stared up at the wooden ceiling and listened to the combined sounds of rain, wind, thunder, and the others' patchy conversation. I tried not to think about how similar this was to the Grey Gull, but it was impossible not to. Lying in here, waiting, felt just like when I'd sat with Winifred in our cabin and prayed to Arinial. Maybe I should do that now. Would she listen, or was she tired of helping me? The memory of a different storm flitted through my memory, the blizzard in Grashand. I found myself smiling as I recalled Dinah insinuating that my friends and I had endured so many trials because we were being punished. And then Jago had responded, "Doesn't seem like a punishment if they keep coming through it just fine. Maybe it's more like a sign of favor, the way the angels look out for them. Maybe they're carrying some divine message for the rest of us and don't even realize it." "Oh, Jago," I murmured. The pain I kept pushed down in my heart reared up without warning. I missed Jago. I missed his wit and how easy it was to talk to him without any need of the caution and formality that had governed my social interactions these last few weeks. I missed his kindness and open nature. I missed the way he'd held me against his chest in bed, how his fingers had stroked my hair while I'd listened to his heartbeat. I covered my eyes, trying to banish tears and memories. I couldn't let longing for the impossible keep me from a future so full of promise. I couldn't. "Can sail across a blasted bay, then they can raid one ship." I jerked upright as Warren's voice cut through the din of the storm. He'd raised it in anger, but dropped it promptly, returning conversation to its previous volume. I scooted over to the door and leaned near the gap, forgetting all my mother's lessons against eavesdropping. "Boats are small," Lawrence was saying.
"He knows what to do," a new voice said. "That's too big a prize to pass up. He knows we won't get a chance at that much ammunition again, and he always sees a job through."
The unfamiliar speaker must have been either Mr. Carpenter or Mr. Smith. I frowned, listening to the deep voice's quality. Those surnames were solidly common as Ridian ones, but this man spoke with a distinctly Lorandian accent.
Which is more than can be said for some people, Warren snapped. If you'd done yours, the Northern army would have been on the move a long time ago.
We did do ours, exclaimed the Lorandian voice. Bossites, just as discussed. One of my men nearly got killed attacking that farmstead, and we even got some ridiculous Ikori clothes when we hit Grashant. I don't know why the army didn't go. No one suspected. Someone, obviously, did.
The regiment up there met with Ikori leaders to investigate the misunderstanding and held off taking any action.
What? Well, when we go back...
No need, Warren interrupted. My bride-to-be did what you couldn't. The North will be going soon, and Campbell's going to take most of the fort's numbers south. She helped do that too, though it also sounds like the attacks our agents did there and in the central colonies were a little more effective. The Lorandian speaker's voice came out as a growl.
I told you, we did what we were supposed to.
Another huge wave tossed us around, and with it, the door's faulty latch gave way. It swung open again, smacking the wall loudly, and I gripped the doorway so that I didn't tumble out. That left me in the awkward and embarrassing position of crouching right there by the door. I stared stupidly at Warren and felt the others watching me. After what felt like an agonizing time, Warren said, "Hello, Tamsin. Are you okay? I'm sorry if your rest was disturbed." An uneasy tone in his voice made me realize he was more concerned about the notion of being overheard than that I might have been purposely trying to listen. Swallowing, I got to my feet and attempted a cheery laugh.
"No, don't worry. It's hard to really rest with that racket out there. But the room was getting stuffy and I..."
The words died from my lips. Until that moment, I'd been focusing on Warren. Now, my eyes lifted from him to the others. Earl. Lawrence. A lanky, unfamiliar man in a brown cloak over workers' clothes must have been one of the associates. I hadn't really been able to see their faces outside. Beside him sat another man, much bigger in build, with a bushy blonde beard. And he, as it turned out, was familiar. He was the same Lorandian who challenged me and Alan, and then had later appeared at Lucan. The man clearly hadn't gotten a good look at me on the deck, and his eyes widened as recognition shot through him. I shrank back instinctively, though of course I had nowhere to go. Warren noted our reactions. "Do you know each other?" My tongue felt thick, and even if I could have spoken, I had no idea what to say. What I knew with certainty was that there was no good answer I could give. After a few more moments of shock, he lumbered to his feet and pointed.
She was there, in Grashant.
Perplexed, Warren glanced between us.
"I know. She came to Cape Triumph by way of the north."
Flushing, the man shook his head.
"She was in Constancy. We held up some of those heirs, and she was with him. I know her face."
"I do too," said the other man slowly, also speaking with a Lorandian accent.
He stood beside his partner, forehead wrinkled in thought.
"Lucan, she was there with that trader Robinson. Jacob Robinson, right? But she was Ikori, wasn't she?"
From the larger man's startled expression, he hadn't noticed me at the trading camp. I had tried to stay out of his sight then, never expecting that someone else would get a good look at me, and later cross my path.
"She was with the heirs," Warren said. "But Lucan, that trading post, she wasn't there. Were you, Tamsin?"
"No, what? A trading post? I ran into traders up north, I told you that, but I don't know that place. Is that the name of a company?"
My words were a perfect mix of confusion and guilelessness, but I hesitated too long in responding.
I could see it in Warren's eyes. He knew I was lying, and a rush of emotions flashed over his face at that realization. Panic, uncertainty, and sadness. I think you and I should go outside. He stood up and gave a small shake of his head when Earl and Lawrence did too. Perhaps some air will help. All right then, I said, forcing a smile. I won't mind seeing how everything's shaping up out there.
Mr. Doyle,
said the bearded Lorandian, his eyes narrowed. I know, said Warren with a sigh. I know. He opened the door for me, and as I stepped out, I saw the others inside sit down and exchange grim looks. On deck, the captain and sailor barely noticed us as they hurried about. Most of their work was in the stern, controlling the rudder and sails, with occasional trips to the starboard side of the bow to check our trajectory. Warren led me to the port side of the bow, where the cabin mostly blocked us from view, but not from the rain.
Tamsin, Warren called over the wind. I'm sure you heard some pretty strange-sounding things in there. A lot of odd things happen in stressful situations.
Yes, of course. Lightning flashed, the brief illumination showing a tight set to his features.
What exactly did you hear us talking about?
Not much of anything, to be honest. Too much noise from the storm. Warren did nothing for several moments, and as the rain continued pouring down, I was about to ask if we could go back in, when he said,
Tamsin, I can almost believe that, looking at your face now. There's no fear, mostly irritation at the rain. And the answer was good. Insisting you'd heard absolutely nothing wouldn't ring true. Maybe you really didn't hear anything. But those men, do you know them?
I shook my head indignantly.
No, and it makes me terribly uneasy to have them looking at me like that, especially that big one. I don't understand what this is about.
Another brief flash showed him studying me intently.
You sound so sincere about that too. You're good, Tamsin, and clever. You can be whatever you need to be, adapt to any situation. I could have used that, truly.
I shifted from foot to foot, again acutely aware that I had nowhere to go.
I'm not following, Mr. Doyle. Can you explain it more, back inside?
He didn't budge.
Given more time and trust, I think I could have made you understand our plans. I think you would have kept my secrets, but we didn't reach that point. And you do know those men, or you recognize them, at least. You know what they were doing, and that's too big a secret for even you.
I told you I don't know them. I don't understand any of this.
I'm sorry, Tamsin.
Lightning forked, and his face really did look remorseful.
I can't risk that cleverness being used against me.
Warren, I...
He was so fast, I hardly saw him move. One moment we were standing there, and the next he was barreling into me. I fell back against the railing, and he was right there with me. He caught hold of my arms and shoved me up over the edge. And then I was falling down, down, down. Thunder trampled part of my scream, and the rest was lost in a mouthful of icy water as I plunged into Denham Bay. Chapter 34. This is death. It had to be. Nothing else could be so black, so cold, so smothering. As I flailed in a panicked attempt to gain any sort of bearing, some distant part of my mind was waiting for Oziel to take my hands and drag me down to his underworld. Calm down, Tamsin. You're going to drag yourself under. I slowed my frantic struggles, which had no real result. I started to sink, and then moved my arms in a gentler, more controlled way, rolling to my stomach and straightening my body. I floated up, just enough for my head to break the surface. I spit out the water in my mouth, took a gulp of air, and was promptly knocked back under when a wave hit me in the face. I emerged again, coughing, and managed to tread water, despite the heavy layers of skirts tangling my legs. Blinking,
I tried to get some sense of where I was. There was water everywhere. Everywhere. Coming from the sky, surrounding my body, still in my nose and throat. Sometimes I floated right along with the waves, bobbing up and down. Other times they crashed into me, splashing my eyes and mouth. As I turned in place, I finally found what I sought, the boat. It was only a splotch of blackness, set with a few yellow lights, but there was no mistaking what it was, or that it was moving away from me. "Wait!" I yelled, instinct driving me to seek help from the only human source I had, even though that very source was the reason I needed help. The storm was too loud for anyone to hear me, though, and in the time it had taken me to recover, the boat had put a good deal of distance between us. I started to swim after it, using the long, sure strokes I'd learned as a child, never guessing back then that they could save my life after someone attempted to kill me. But I soon stopped. There was no way I could catch up with it. I watched it get farther and farther away, soon melding into the rest of the black bay. Was Warren there, staring at the boat's wake, watching where he'd sent me to drown? Probably not. He'd have to go to the stern for that, where the captain was. Warren had hurled me far enough, and I'd been under long enough that the crew probably hadn't even noticed a thing. Surely the boat would be doubling back if the crew realized someone had gone over, right? Or was Warren's sway too strong? I pushed those musings away. What went on in that boat made no difference to me now. My biggest priority, my only priority, was staying alive. Already, I was tiring from treading water. I was out of practice, and my clothes were heavy. Constantly having to readjust after waves struck my nose and eyes didn't help. And it was cold. Everything was so, so cold. A flare of lightning gave me a brief glimpse of the coast before darkness swallowed it up again. Yes, I could still see land, just like when I'd started out tonight. But did it matter if I couldn't swim to it? I had no choice. If I was going to drown, it might as well be trying to reach the shore and not staying in one spot in the middle of the bay. In the lightning's unreliable illumination, the nearest land seemed to be in a more leftward direction than the boat had gone. Another wave broke against me, and after a moment of coughing, I set off for the coast. Decision made, I experienced a rush of energy as the adrenaline of determination went through me. I moved well, stayed strong, and didn't even swallow that much water. And then, the fatigue came again. I had to stop a couple of times and rest from the more aggressive swimming just to catch my breath. But when I'd start up again, my muscles were still tired. I couldn't move as forcefully or cover the distance I had earlier. And when, on another break, I reassessed the shore, it seemed I'd hardly made progress at all. Panic started to make me falter. I was weakening. I didn't have the stamina to reach the shore. My strokes grew smaller, hardly moving me at all. I became less adept at keeping water out of my nose and mouth. And six, it was cold. Another bolt of lightning. They were becoming infrequent, and the wind and rain had lessened too. But in that flash, I saw something up ahead on the water. Something red. It was there, and then gone. Was there another boat? If so, why didn't it have any lights? Hope gave me a second wind, and I swam in the direction I'd seen the blur of red, praying for more lightning. When it came, I saw I'd made progress toward that phantom object, but that it was too small to be a boat. It had a roundish shape, and something stuck out from its top. A buoy, I realized, the ones the captain had seen that marked the shoals. It wasn't a boat, but it did float. My second wind had faded by then, and I mustered what I could of a third one, pushing my body until my muscles burned, and then pushing them some more. More than once, I thought I'd sink in exhaustion. But I kept thinking of Mary, Adelaide, Mira, Jago, and all the other people counting on me.
I reached it at last, my lungs bursting. The buoy was about 3 feet in diameter, with a flat top that gave it the appearance of a squashed barrel. A wooden pole with a wildly whipping flag jutted up from its center, and I used the pole as a handle to pull myself on top of the buoy. Gasping, aching, I collapsed against the flagpole and offered a silent prayer of thanks. I was alive. I lay there for a long time, staring without seeing, just regaining my strength. The waves tossed the buoy around a bit, but I was never in danger of getting dunked. The wind grew still, and the rain diminished, spurring me to utter another prayer of thanks. But when I squinted, I could see lightning dancing among the clouds on the horizon, steadily coming closer. This was the eye, as deceptively calm as the ocean's storms had been. The onslaught would be back. I sat up a little, using the pole for support again, and then realized the last place I wanted to be in a thunderstorm was next to a tall, pointed object. Actually, that was the next to last place I wanted to be. The last one was the open water, and there was no way I was leaving the buoy. As the storm's wrath rolled back in, I felt up and down the pole. It was old and soaked, and I found one section I was certain was weaker than the rest. I got on my knees, pushing and pulling with all of my tepid strength, and incredibly, I broke the pole. Not gracefully. It was splintery and jagged, but I'd taken a few feet off it. I was still the highest thing around, but there was nothing else to be done. Grasping the broken pole, I curled up on the buoy, making myself as low as I could while staying out of the water. And then I waited. And waited. I not only had to wait out the storm as it returned with its former intensity, I also had to wait out the night. I passed it in a sort of exhausted daze, but never truly slipped. When morning arrived, the sky was clear, and the rising sun finally gave me some sense of direction. Following the curve of the coast, I could see that I appeared to be in the southwestern part of the bay, which fit with what the captain had said about seeing southern buoys. But again, just like last night, even the closest section of shoreline was too far for me to swim without a break. I put a hand to my eyes, trying to discern any other buoys I could use as waypoints to land. There likely were some, but I couldn't count on finding one. So why not take this one with me? Knowing it'd have to happen sooner or later, I jumped back into the water, crying out as I went from just cold to freezing. I swam around the buoy, diving under a few times to determine its setup. A rope extended from its bottom surface, presumably down to an anchor somewhere. There was no way I could untie it. The rope didn't feel like it was on the verge of disintegration, but it was worn and waterlogged. I climbed back up on top of the buoy and examined the flagpole I'd broken. The little pennant was held on with two metal clasps. I slid one off, and after hammering it against the buoy enough times, managed to flatten it somewhat. One of the metal strip's corners was quite sharp, and I used it as a knife, beginning the long and painstaking process of going underneath the buoy, sawing away at the rope with my makeshift blade, and then coming back up for air. It was well into the morning when I finally broke the last strands of rope. The buoy popped free of its anchor and listed to one side. I was worn out enough by then that I would have liked to rest again, but with nothing to hold it, the buoy was already drifting at the whims of the waves and light wind. Holding onto the buoy with my arms, I turned toward the shore and used my legs to propel me forward. I moved faster than I had swimming on my own, and although I was still worn out, I at least had the comfort of something to hold onto when I stopped, instead of simply sinking. The sun was at its zenith when I finally staggered onto a shore of jagged grey rocks. I pulled the buoy with me, and then sank onto the flattest spot I could find. I buried my face in my hands and started crying, softly at first, and then giving myself over to great sobs that shook my body and snatched at my breath. If my throat wasn't so raw, I would have screamed my frustration to the world. When I finally calmed down, I took stock of what I knew. If I'd come from the southern section of Denham Bay, then I was in the northern part of Denham Colony. Northwest, I supposed, scrutinizing the shape of the coast. I was days from Cape Triumph, but in theory, all I had to do to reach it was follow the shore east. Or, if I headed due south, I might hit a road like the one I'd taken in from Ikori territory. What else did I know? I was freezing. Even though the day had warmed up into another almost summery one, the icy water had chilled me to the bone. I kept moving my toes and poking my numbed limbs. They all still seemed to work. I was hungry, thirsty, and exhausted. I had nothing but the drenched clothes I wore and whatever tools I could scrape together from the buoy. No one knew I was here, so no one would come looking for me. Oh, and Warren Doyle wanted me dead. Actually, he probably assumed I already was. I would too, in his position. Images from last night tumbled back through my mind, hardly seeming real. How had I gone from boarding a boat with dreams of being a governor's wife to being left for dead by said governor? You do know those men, or you recognize them, at least. You know what they were doing, and that's too big a secret for even you. I didn't know what they were doing, and I'd never even seen the smaller one. I rubbed my forehead, trying to piece together the scraps of conversation I'd heard and what it could mean that a Lorandian who raided under the guise of an Ikori was spending time with Warren. But it was all too much in my current state. The memories and bits of information slipped through my hands when I'd tried to hold on to them. The only thing I could be sure of was that I'd stumbled onto something powerful enough for Warren to try to kill me and face whatever fallout came of it in Cape Triumph. It was that chilling thought that finally drove me to my feet. Someone paranoid enough to kill another person for overhearing a conversation might very well be paranoid enough to double-check his work. I salvaged everything I could from the buoy that might be useful later. The metal clasps, the pole, rope fragments, and even the flag itself. The rest of the buoy I hid in the forest, behind the gravelly beach. Then I slipped off into the trees, trying to use the sun as a guide to keep me headed south. If I could find a road, then maybe I could find help. I would have even settled for a trail to save me from picking my way through all the roots, undergrowth, and fallen branches. The weather might be pleasant now, but signs of the storm's passing were everywhere. Surveying all that it had knocked down in this forest made me wonder how Cape Triumph had fared. Had the storm taken out trees there? Buildings? Were my friends okay? They were probably better off than me, I thought bitterly. No one tried to kill them last night. As I walked and gleaned some warmth from the sun, I tried again to pick through the jumble of last night's events. 5 minutes before pushing me overboard, Warren had been planning to marry me. From his comments, he might have even been planning to make me a co-conspirator in... what? That was the life or death question. He had Lorandian associates, that I knew for a fact. Lorandians who'd been trying to make Asphridians and Ikori think each was under attack by the other. Jago and I had been right about that, at least in the north. My bride-to-be did what you couldn't. The north will be going soon, and Campbell's going to take most of the fort's number south. She helped do that too, though it also sounds like the attacks our agents did there and in the central colonies were a little more effective. My steps slowed, and I leaned against a tree, partially to pull my thoughts together, and partially because I was getting dizzy.
the attacks our agents did there and in the central colonies. What agents did he mean? Not Lorandian ones, judging by the big man's indignation. Our agents, as Phrydian agents? Was that the implication, that the Lorandians had staged skirmishes in the north, and conspiring as Phrydians had done them in other places, like the hunting camp along the East River? I closed my eyes. If that was true, then Jago and I had been right about the reports of all the Ikori raids being fabricated. They were just being done by different factions. A drop of water splashed onto my forehead, and I blinked back to my surroundings. Another drop followed. Stepping aside, I squinted upward and saw the culprit. Water had pooled on a large leaf above me and finally lost its balance. I didn't know the tree type, but the other leaves that were open were also broad and curved down in a way that let water collect. I backtracked to a log I'd passed earlier and dragged it to the tree. Using it as a stool, I climbed up. I carefully plucked water-filled leaves off and slurped their contents. A few times, I found it easier to let the leaves stay as they were and just bring my mouth up to them. When I didn't feel so parched anymore, I continued on, but took a few of the cup-shaped leaves with me. My travelling outfit was actually in no way designed to be helpful for travelling, aside from two gold-embroidered pockets on the front of the skirt. I kept the leaves in there, with some of my salvaged buoy bits. The water went a long way toward restoring me, but I wanted food, too. Denim was in true spring now, but the pickings were slim. The most plentiful things I found were dandelion greens, and though they were edible, I knew too many would hurt the stomach, especially when dehydrated. I'd have to keep looking. Just as twilight was approaching, I finally came to a road. It wasn't as wide or packed down as the one our caravan had taken to Cape Triumph, but it had seen enough wear to suggest it was used a lot. I turned onto it, putting the sunset behind me. I encountered no other travellers, but the road did cross a small, bubbling stream via a bare-bones wooden bridge. My thirst had returned, and I hopped down the bank. When I reached a particularly rapid part of the stream, I used my leaves to gather more water. I'd have to camp for the night, I realized. I had no tent or cloak for protection, though. In their attempts to teach Gideon to live in the wild, Briga and Aeroch had talked about shelters, but I'd only half listened. Could I build one? I had no construction knowledge, save watching Pa on some of his jobs. The storm had made the woods a feast of building materials, so surely something could be managed. Earlier in the day, I'd hoped to find other people who might offer direction. Once evening's shadows grew longer, though, I decided it might be wiser to pass the night without encountering any strangers. I walked upstream until I felt I was far enough from the road to avoid detection. After a lot of trial and error with various tree and plant materials, I ended up with a lean-to type of structure, composed of fallen limbs set against a sloping section of land above the stream bed. I thatched the outside of the limbs with pine boughs and dried leaves, weaving some in and just piling up others. It made a snug little enclosure that would keep me out of sight and reasonably warm. I decided to pass on a fire as much as I longed for the extra heat. It was another way to attract attention, and I had nothing to cook over it. I'd have to put it out before sleeping anyway. My clothes, though stiff, had dried, and the weather was far milder than what I'd camped in farther north. That left me with deepening shadows as the sun set, and no way to banish them. It was probably just as well. I needed the sleep. I trekked down to get one last drink of water, and as I knelt at the rushing stream, the fleeting light caught a flash of silver that quickly vanished. Fish. The clawing sensation in my empty stomach intensified, just thinking about fish cooked over a campfire. That, at least, was something I'd paid attention to with the Ikori. I'd learned all about how they set their clever fish traps in cages out in the river each night. The problem was, I had nothing even remotely close to that on hand, and no way to build one. Maybe by weaving dried vines? I had no time to find them. I stared at the stream, my insides aching. Some of the ikori traps had clever flaps that let fish come in, but not exit. A couple of baskets had simply relied on the current funneling fish in, who then had trouble finding the way out. Conscious of the rapidly growing darkness, I scouted the closest parts of the stream and found one where the bed bulged out a little. I gathered every rock and stick I could obtain quickly, not screening for size or uniformity, using them to construct a barrier that was a hybrid of wall and fence, stacking rocks and shoving in sticks until I'd sectioned off the bulbous part. I made my barrier like the ikori baskets, open and wide on the upstream side, narrowing to a point on the downstream side. The ikori used bait, which I didn't have time for, so I'd just have to hope for fish straying in on their own and being too stupid to find the way out. And with that, I crawled into my lean-to, pulling a few more branches against it to close off the opening. I rolled to my side and was wondering how I'd ever fall asleep in such strange conditions when, pushed past exhaustion, I dropped into a deep slumber. I woke to birds singing and bright sunshine pouring in through the cracks of my roof. I wiggled my way out and stretched muscles that had stiffened from both the cramped quarters and hours of swimming. Walking to the stream, I brushed off leaves and dirt that had stuck to me overnight, as well as a few bugs I tried not to think too much about. Yawning, I crouched at the river for a morning drink and tried to gauge the time. Well past sunrise, I'd slept in, which was understandable. Now I had to. I sprang to my feet. I'd forgotten all about my hasty fish trap. But there, about 10 feet downstream, one fish, not quite as long as my hand, butted obstinately against the rocks. I whooped with joy before I could stop myself, feeling as victorious as I would have taking down a wolf with my bare hands. I quickly snatched the fish out before it could escape and built a fire that Briga wouldn't have criticized too much. I gutted the fish as best I could with sharp sticks and the blade I'd made from the buoy latch, and then set it to cooking on a skewer. The minutes dragged by as I stared at it, and I had to stay my hand from pulling it off too early. When I finally deemed it edible, I nearly burned myself in my haste to get it off. I ate with little grace and no silverware, and it was delicious. I found the road again and resumed my journey east, or east-ish, seeing as the road didn't stay perfectly straight. Food and sleep had done wonders, and I moved at a brisk pace. About midday, I finally encountered other travellers on the road. The sound of hooves alerted me to them before they came into view, and I quickly ducked behind some roadside bushes, hoping for a safe and friendly family. 3 men on horseback trotted by instead, their clothes rough and practical, and after a moment's deliberation, I stayed concealed. I couldn't say from a glance if they were trustworthy or not, and yesterday's events had left me wary. What I did note was that they carried no supplies. Even considering the ground a horse could cover, they must have come from a settled place. That gave me hope. I felt a lot better about finding help in a small town than from strangers on an isolated road. I set off again, and about 2 hours later, I came to a small crossroads marked with a hand-carved wooden sign that named my current road as the Bay Highway. The small intersecting road had no name, but beside an arrow pointing south, letters read, 30 miles to Governor's Highway, 100 miles to Cape Triumph. I knew the Governor's Highway. We'd taken it from the East River. It was the most direct route across Denham to Cape Triumph.
But 130 miles, that'd take almost 6 days on foot. I was farther west than I'd realized, but I had little choice if I wanted to get back to the glittering court and Mary. An arrow pointing east, where I was headed on the Bay Highway, was labelled Coatesville Road to Newville, 10 miles. Coatesville? Where had I heard that name? In a flash, the memory came rushing back. Mr. Elkhart, parting ways from our caravan shortly after we'd crossed the border into Denham. Going to drop Robinson's stuff off in Rushwick on my way to Coatesville. Rushwick was where Jago's land was. Was I near it? I peered around as though the forest with its rustling leaves and singing birds might offer some direction. Mr. Elkhart had gone north from the Governor's Highway, and his comment had suggested Rushwick came before Coatesville from that direction. If I was putting everything together correctly now on my mental map, I was on the opposite side. I'd reach Coatesville first, with Rushwick somewhere after. Except Coatesville itself was not marked on the sign, only Coatesville Road. But generally, roads named after towns led to those towns. If I could find Coatesville, could I find Jago's home? Could I find Jago? All the feelings I'd been trying to bury these long weeks, all the longing for him, it came bursting forth in a great rush. I nearly ran off then and there. But what would I accomplish? What would finding Jago mean? Safety. There was no question I had to eventually return to Cape Triumph for Mary, but I didn't know what would be waiting for me. Did anyone even know something amiss had happened? Had Warren told them anything? Or had he continued on to Haddison, leaving others in blissful ignorance about me? I knew I'd find safety at Wisteria Hollow, but I had no idea how long it would last if someone was intent on killing me. There were very few people I could trust right now, I realized, but Jago was one of them. And he had the resources and wits to help me make sense of this disaster I'd fallen into. The urgency to go to him burned within my chest, and while, yes, my overall well-being was on the line, I also selfishly, desperately, wanted to see him again. But would he want to see me? Yes, I decided. Or, well, he would see me, even if he didn't want to. And he would help me, despite what I'd done to him. Because that's how he was. That realization should have relieved me as I began to walk. But mostly, it made me sad. 2 hours later, a small and unmarked road crossed mine. It had to be the Coatesville Road, based on the timing. But where was Coatesville? North or south? Where was Newville, the town referenced on the sign? Unease filled the pit of my stomach as I glanced back and forth and weighed my options. At last, I turned south. The road's northern section looked less travelled. If there were 3 towns that way, I'd expect more traffic. And due north led to the bay. I hadn't travelled that far from it. It seemed unlikely there'd be 3 towns in so small a distance. The odds leaned south, and if it turned out I'd misjudged, I'd most certainly hit the Governor's Highway eventually and could continue on to Cape Triumph. There were a lot of ifs and leaps in my deduction, but that was pretty much all I was going on lately. I travelled the rest of the day without finding any sign of human habitation, which made me worry I wasn't even on the Coatesville Road. As it grew a little wider and more worn, though, I took comfort in knowing I was at least on some main thoroughfare. But would it lead me to Jago? I camped another night and set out at first light. Not long after that, I scored a victory when I came upon the town of Newville. Town was something of a stretch, though. It mostly consisted of a few bare buildings set back from the road. Beyond them, where the forest grew deeper, I heard the sound of wood being chopped. Newville was some sort of lumber camp, it seemed. I saw no residents. I wouldn't have given those buildings a second glance if not for another road sign identifying the settlement. And on it, underneath Newville, were words that made my heart sing.
Coatesville, 10 miles. I was on the right course. Half a day's travel, and I'd hopefully find some answers. I might even find Jago, depending on how far Rushwick was. Even though that had been my plan in turning south yesterday, the idea of actually seeing him was startling. Part of me had doubted it could ever happen again, and I spent those next 10 miles in a non-stop whirl of emotions. Exhilaration, regret, nervousness, fear. I would understand if he didn't love me anymore. I almost expected it after what I'd done to him. But what if he didn't like me anymore? What if he didn't respect me? Imagining those warm, friendly green and gold eyes turning cold made a pit open up in my stomach. That dreary thought sapped some of my vigour, and my steps began to flag, until I caught the faint sound of wagons and voices ahead. As I regained my speed, the noises grew louder and louder, and before I knew it, I was strolling into Coatesville. There was no missing it. It was a real town, a little bigger than Constancy, bustling with people going about their daily tasks and businesses selling their services. I found a general store and sold my brooch, which was about the only thing of value I had on me. Most of the money went toward food, but I also got a few other handy things. Flint, a tiny knife, twine, and a water skin. It all just fit in an old sack the storekeeper gave me for free after eyeing my bedraggled state. I was almost tempted by a fresh set of clothes, but instead settled for a plain cotton apron to cover the dirty and matted velvet. Food mattered more. The storekeeper told me Rushwick was another 20 miles south, and I wanted to be prepared. I didn't know what I'd find there, if I'd even find Jago at all. I might very well be right back out in the woods or on the Governor's Highway. And though I had gotten pretty adept at building fish traps on the creek running alongside the Coatesville Road, I couldn't count on that option either. I left Coatesville in late afternoon, making camp around sunset. When I set out again in the morning, the land began to change. After the endless forest of western Denham, I was surprised to see the trees thin out, giving way to rolling hills and meadows of some of the greenest grass I'd ever encountered. Once, I spied a large, affluent country house a ways off the road. Several horses pranced happily on the emerald green pasture, and I felt tears well in my eyes, thinking how Jago must love this place. When I reached Rushwick proper, I found it was more developed than Newville, but a long ways from being anything like Constancy or Coatesville. Rushwick was a fledgling town, emerging as a result of the increased development of those swathes of green. They were apparently especially well suited for grapes, hemp, and horses.
"Most residents live outside a town on farms and plantations," a harried storekeeper named Branson Myers told me. He specialized in seed and was also a member of the town's governing council. Someone on the street had referred me to him when I'd come asking about Jago.
"I don't know half of the townspeople," he said. "Excuse me a moment."
I waited until Mr. Myers finished up with a customer before asking more about Jago. "Isn't there some, I don't know, directory?" he guffawed.
"That would be great, wouldn't it? The area built up too quickly. Last year, the governor opened up land here and bam!" Mr. Myers clapped his hands for emphasis. "There was a mad rush, which is great ultimately. I mean, most of them buy their seed from me, but we didn't have the manpower to keep up with the details, if you know what I mean. When there were a dozen landowners, me and the other four councilmen took turns playing clerk, never even bothered with a town manager or assessor. Now, there's more than 50. Hang on."
"But I have an address," I said, once he'd tended to his next task. "Orchard End."
"Still doesn't help. Not me, at least. I'm sure it's in one of the ownership deeds. We've got those, but they're not very well organized."
"I think he only just bought it, or he might be about to. He was leasing it."
"Oh, one of those. They aren't organized at all. Hey, Bill, hold on a minute. I'll be right back."
Mr. Myers led me two doors down to a building labeled Town Office.
He unlocked the door and waved grandly at a small room with a dilapidated desk and dusty stacks of paper.
"If you want to try and find it, you're welcome to it," he said. "You can't really make things worse."
Gaping, I stared in